This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Raining radiation, it's the latest man-made thing. Comes inside your milk now, so let's everybody sing. It's raining radiation, it's raining toxic stuff. It's raining radiation, and I think we've had enough. Don't you think we've had enough? You know, nukes make dirty stuff, and I think we've had enough.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, to the program I Didn't Want to Make. I'm Alex Smith, and I have an important show ready for you about rapidly depleting oil supplies. Post-peak oil will change all of our lives in the next few years much sooner than we thought. My recorded speech explains the forces behind high prices at the gas pump. It would be a hugely popular topic in North America. Lots of folks want to know why prices are going so high. Instead, I have more news nobody wants to hear about. Yes, it's the continuing nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan. According to the mainstream media, that is all over. The only stories I see explain how Japan regained control over the damaged reactors, how radiation is going down, plus a flourish of announcements about new plans to attain the holy grail of cold shutdown. Just the opposite is happening. I tried to ignore the steady stream of jaw-dropping news, historic high levels of radioactivity just last week, mega radiation released again and again, unconfirmed rumors about another reactor fire. But three stories finally tipped me over the edge, forcing me to make this Fukushima update for you. First, I've seen undeniable video footage reported on Russian TV that Reactor 4 is leaning badly, with the possibility the building could fall over. I'll tell you why that is a risk to the whole world. Then Japan suddenly released an aerial map of radioactive contamination developed with the U.S. Energy Agency. It shows horrible radiation far outside the 20-kilometer exclusion zone, up to 80 kilometers away from the damaged nuclear plant. Why aren't these people being evacuated? The final straw, children inside that real radiation zone, like those in the Japanese city of Fukushima, about 63 kilometers or 39 miles from the nuclear plant, the kids are being kept inside because their playgrounds are too radioactive to allow them outside. Why are these children being kept inside radioactive hot zones? At least save the children, those most at risk for radiation poisoning and long-term cancer. But no, they are still there, even after locals brought contaminated playground soil to authorities in a protest unusual in Japan. That's just the tip of a meltdown. Three reactors admittedly melted down. At least two nuclear spent fuel ponds are partly blown up or leaking. Radiation levels are higher than Chernobyl. Two reactors are heating up dangerously, one even beyond the normal operating temperature in an ongoing reactor. This amid a culture of hidden nuclear worker poisoning and a history of withholding nasty nuclear facts. You need to know, and I need to tell you, let us suffer through this awful mess together for two reasons. This radioactivity still pouring out daily has reached my home, and it has reached your home. It is blanketing planet Earth right now, and no one has been able to stop it. And, as the head of the United Nations admits, this is not the last nuclear accident. The aging reactors of the world are being patched up and relicensed even after Fukushima. The nuclear danger is multiplying. With no obvious signs of resistance, we do not even have a living anti-nuclear movement yet. Here's a report of a fun nuclear power protest held in Berlin in late April 2006. They handed out canisters, or tried to, of radioactive materials and then reenacted what would happen if nuclear materials spilled all over the streets. Imagine the public freedom that's involved in being able to do these protests. In America, they would all be dragged off to jail, charged with terrorism, and what would we give them? 20 years? Life? Maybe three life sentences. Nothing is too much to stop public protest or even expression about great fears on nuclear power on the streets.
Also, we have a big action on Saturday, and we would like to make a statement also to create public awareness, not only amongst the participants of the conference, but in general of people in Berlin, just pedestrians passing by.
These actions included the distribution of chocolate nuclear power plants in conjunction with a packet of tablets to prevent radiation contamination. Other people handed out bunches of tulips with flyers informing people about the use of biomass as an alternative energy. Although some of the other demonstrations were a little more confronting, as Bujal explains.
I took part in the delivery of containers to the broad public, and we're walking around the streets with yellow containers with a radioactive sign on them, and then we were asking the people to take the containers home if they wanted or if they had a place to store them, but there was almost nobody that wanted to. There were people scared. We left one of the containers on a bus stop, and there was this guy who was sitting there, and he ran.
Jan was one of the Youth Energy Summit organisers coordinating the public demonstration. His group acted out a nuclear accident. They carried a pretend transport of nuclear waste through the city. Then the cargo spilled out onto the ground and there was radioactive material everywhere. Some participants played dead, while others came in to clean up the mess.
Everyone collapsed, and the nuclear cleaning up team came up to put the people away, to cover them and to say hello, there's no problem, even if there's a nuclear super catastrophe. We wanted to show with that even if there's a catastrophe like Chernobyl, the nuclear power plant owners doesn't care of our future. Even if there's a high risk, they say, okay, let's cover it, we have all under control, the media is under control.
The reactions this scene provoked were quite diverse.
There have been people just looking what we are doing, being totally confused.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Living Planet. Remember, you can download the program as a podcast. You'll find that on our website, dwworld.de/English.
There is some good news. On May 10th, Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan appears to have cancelled plans to build 14 new nuclear reactors in that country. Such a step was unimaginable before Fukushima. Prime Minister Kan also requested and got the closure of what has long been considered Japan's most dangerous reactor, the Hamaoka Nuclear Power Station. Some reports suggest the Americans pressured this decision, fearing radiation risk to nearby bases at Yokota, Yokosuka, Atsugi, and Zama. Like the American nuclear power plants at San Onofre and Diablo Canyon in California, this Hamaoka nuclear plant is right on the earthquake fault zone, on the ocean with not enough tsunami defenses, and way too close to heavily populated areas. As far as I know, this is the first time in human history an operating nuclear power plant was closed down because it was insanely dangerous to keep it open. One down, over 400 left to go. Even more amazing and hopeful for our future, if it's not too late, Naoto Kan also announced Japan will build sustainable energy instead of more nuclear power. The new Japan may be powered by the sun, the wind, and geothermal energy. All this is really important news, a possible breakthrough turning point for all of us if we can get our own governments to listen. Get them to act before another Fukushima. Perhaps Japan can lead us all out of our twin addictions to fossil fuels and nuclear power. It could be an example to the world. Let it be. Meanwhile, though, the price paid is terrible. The news coming out of Fukushima is sad and frightening. Our own media has failed us completely. In the West, government minders are going backward, removing crucial radiation monitoring devices. Fringe bloggers, a few brave independent Japanese journalists, a few independent physicists and doctors, and one small radio program. That's what we have, and you. Forwarding links, tweeting, Facebooking, getting the word out, not giving up. So here we go. All the news that should have been told, packed under pressure, into one more radio show for you.
Hey there, mister, take a good look at my country. It's a natural, bona fide high. When you look words on your paper. You might see Yaki star pass you by. You might see it all pass you by.
This is Radio EcoShock. Let's start with those three news stories that made me mad. Reactor 4 at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant was severely damaged by a hydrogen explosion on March 15th. Theoretically, that should never have happened. The reactor had been shut down for several months for maintenance. Following a Japanese practice, not allowed in the United States, all of the unused fuel rods, 204 of them, were moved into the spent fuel pool right above the reactor. That pool was already the most heavily loaded at the site, we think, with 1,331 spent fuel rods already in the pond. There is far more radioactive material in this Reactor 4 pond than ever existed at Chernobyl. Even though the reactor was not running, the concrete and steel outer building at Reactor 4 blew up violently. Following the earthquake March 11th, the water ran dry in the pool. A reaction took place creating hydrogen, which collected in the outer shell and then exploded. There were fires in the building for 2 days, recorded on video from a great distance. We can presume a giant plume of radiation escaped, blowing mostly out to sea due to the wind direction, but also onto the land of Japan. In that pool fire explosion and continuing daily radioactive steam, there are the worst and most long-lasting elements, including plutonium, uranium, strontium, of course cesium, and others we seldom hear about. There is a lot of speculation about what caused this original damage to the fuel pond. Former nuclear executive Arne Gundersen suggested the earthquake caused a crack in the fuel pool. The plant operator, Tokyo Electric, known as TEPCO, suggests radioactive debris fell into the Reactor 4 pool due to the much larger explosion at Reactor 3 next door the day before. What we do know from recent video and from footage shot by drone flyovers, the Reactor 4 building was very severely damaged. It looks like a wreck, not a reactor building. We can see right through parts of it, like looking through a skeleton. Now, as reported by Russia Today TV, analysis of video shows the whole Reactor 4 building is tilting badly. Dr. Robert Jacobs is a research associate professor of nuclear history and culture at the Hiroshima Peace Institute in Japan. Here he is on Russia Today TV, May 10th, North American time.
And of course, the situation's far from over, isn't it? There's speculation now that the fourth reactor is leaning and is in danger of falling. How great a concern is that?
It's a very, very serious concern. This began as speculation among those of us watching the incident, because on the webcam in which you can watch it, you can look at the four reactors, it began to be obvious that building number four was leaning to the right a little bit from the visual field of the webcam. And now, just tonight, actually, in a release of information from the Japanese government, they have confirmed that there has been work started yesterday to shore up the structure of the building, and specifically the upper floor. Now, in this reactor, you have the spent fuel pool that is a much larger spent fuel pool. It has fuel rods from 3 to 4 reactors in there. And this part of the building is beginning to lean. And because of the explosion of Reactor 3, there is some questions about the structural integrity of the building of Reactor 4, and if that were to collapse, you would have all of the fuel in that spent fuel pool just scattered about on the ground, and outside of increasing a very, very high level of contamination, you would also have radiation rise to levels that would make it very problematic for workers to continue to work on the site at all.
Now, just lastly and briefly, if you would, Dr. Jacobs, from what you've been saying, it's clear that the situation at Fukushima does remain critical, yet the silence that we're getting is quite deafening. Isn't it? Why aren't we hearing more about a facility that's still at risk of causing great amounts of devastation?
Well, in these situations, managing public opinion is as serious an operation as managing the crisis itself. What you have here in Fukushima is you have four reactors that are all still emitting significant amounts of radiation into the environment. So this is not a situation that has been brought under control. It is a situation in which the large releases have been largely, the explosions of the first week have been gone past, but now we just have ongoing leakage. So to continue to tell people about that leakage and to continue to provide a lot of information about that leakage will cause higher levels of distress and also the perception that neither TEPCO nor the government is in control of the situation. So it's a lot easier to just reduce the amount of information that the public has so that you're able to control the situation, at least from the point of view of public opinion, and keep people from panicking.
Okay, Dr. Robert Jacobs from the Hiroshima Peace Institute. Many thanks for speaking to us about the ongoing situation at Fukushima. Many thanks.
2 weeks ago in my Radio EcoShock program titled Fukushima Drama, I reported weakness in the structure of the reactor 4 spent fuel pool and Japanese proposals to build several concrete pillars under it. Now it appears the work has started among a cascade of catastrophic possibilities at this nuclear plant. Beginning this work at Reactor 4 underlines how severe and serious this threat is. Remember, too, there was a lot of very hot radioactive debris around both Reactors 3 and 4. Some of it, possibly including parts of fuel rods blown out by explosions, was dragged into a dirt pit on the site by remote-controlled bulldozers. Workers will be risking their lives to work on the Reactor 4 building. But as you'll hear later in this program, the Japanese nuclear industry is no stranger to using up expendable workers to clean up a mess. Meanwhile, an unmanned modified cement arm is pouring up to 200 tons of water a day into that spent fuel pool at Reactor 4. They've pulled that back a little bit, but they're still pumping in a lot. Where is it all going? Some is going back up into the air as radioactive steam. We can see that on live video cams. Reactor 4 has been steaming or smoking ever since the accident 2 months ago. Depending on the wind, the radiation either goes out to sea or over Japan for many miles inland. More tons of this water from Reactor 4 are collecting at the Fukushima Daiichi site itself. The turbine halls and the trenches continue to fill up. The unheard-of levels of radioactive pollution has reached the groundwater. Some of that goes into the sea. Some of it goes back inland, we know not where. We do know the sewage systems of Fukushima Prefecture are filled with nuclear poisons. Just another horror story barely mentioned in the Western media. Oh, by the way, sewage systems are loaded with radioactivity. It started May 1st with a report from GG Press in Japan. Being a small country with few resources, the Japanese attempt to recycle almost everything. So they burn their sewage sludge, producing a kind of slag that is sold off to Japanese cement companies, who turn them into blocks and other cement products. The treatment plant in Koriyama, Japan, measured 26,400 becquerels of cesium in every single kilogram of sludge. The slag itself measured a staggering 334,000 becquerels per kilo. Local officials admitted 10 tons a day were sent out to a cement company, totaling 500 tons since the earthquake in early March. Of course, just burning the sludge also spews radioactive materials into the local air. You didn't see it in the New York Times? This story came to me through an excellent blog at ex-skf.blogspot.com. That's ex-skf.blogspot.com. That blogger not only translates from Japanese newspapers and TV, but often runs the Japanese original text along with the English version. It's authoritative and helpful. In fact, this blogger is a bulldog following stories down. On May 5th, the blog reports via the newspaper Yomiuri Shimbun, May 3rd, Japan's third largest cement maker, Sumitomo Osaka Cement, bought the hot sludge from Koriyama City. Unknowingly, radioactive cement products had already been shipped to Tochigi, Bunma, and Ibaraki prefectures, among others. Just like the groundwater, this is how the nuclear mess flows outward into the country and into the world. Nobody expected it. The cement company reported double the amount of sludge purchased, now 928 tons, not 500 as originally said. According to our blogger at ex-skf, there are 62 sewage plants in Fukushima Prefecture. The Japanese press reports the government tested sludge at 19 more sewage facilities and found high concentrations of radioactive cesium in 18 of them. That includes the big plant Horikawa Machi in Fukushima City, where 446,000 becquerels per kilogram of radioactive cesium was found. That's just incredible. That's so much radiation. Likely all the other untested plants in Fukushima Prefecture and others further away are also radioactive. Our blogger calls this one big dirty bomb from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. How did all the sewage plants in this big region of Japan become radioactive? Did it fall as contaminated rain? That must be everywhere. Or is it running in through radioactive groundwater? Or both? So far, the government of Japan has not said. You see what I mean? This is one story alone that would be a bombshell anywhere else in the world at any other time. We don't even know how big and how far this nuclear accident will spread. It hasn't happened. It is just getting started. Many of you have asked about the difference between things like chest X-rays and the radiation floating over from the Fukushima accident. Here is the best answer I've found from a video conference call made by Maggie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates and Marco Kaltoffen from Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, USA.
This is Maggie Gunderson, and I'm the president and founder of Fairwinds Associates, and I'm really happy to welcome you here today. Today, as a change of pace, we have a special guest, and that is Marco Kaltoffen. He is an expert in radiation chemistry and monitoring.
Thank you very much for having me. Actually, I'm working on a dissertation. I'm just an older grad student at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And what my research is in is nuclear fallout and tracking it over long distances. One of the things that's very interesting about the Fukushima radiation releases is that we often hear about general radiation levels, things people measure by sticking a Geiger counter out a car window, for instance. What I'm looking at are microscopic or even nanoscale particles that contain highly radioactive materials that are small enough that they can just blow with the wind and sometimes travel great distances. In our research, we've been able to track some of these particles hundreds of miles, even thousands of miles. And what happens is, unlike the radiation we're seeing in Japan, where someone can just move, drive away from a high radiation zone, these particles travel globally, and if they're inhaled, if someone breathes them in, you actually carry that with you in your body. It has a very different impact, and it's the kind of radiation where background doesn't mean as much. It's more a matter of how do we avoid eating or breathing in those radioactive particles.
How is this different than, say, dental X-rays?
Well, the thing about a dental X-ray is it's a set amount of radiation. We can predict better what is going to happen to someone who has that kind of dose, that amount of radioactivity. With a particle, it's very different. A single particle can carry a pretty significant amount of radiation. And wherever it lands in your body, it can start to damage that tissue or kill cells. Cells that actually survive that kind of irradiation could potentially form a tumor. So we worry about how these particles travel, whether they're traveling through the air and we breathe them in, or whether they get absorbed into our food and water. We should behave differently if we want to avoid that kind of radiation. And the thing about a particle, of course, is it travels a long distance, but it doesn't change very much. And now we're beginning to see some of these radioactive particles appearing in air in the United States that look very much like the particles we find in Japan. Our early data is showing that particles that contain americium, europium, bismuth, uranium, and other radioactive materials are found in the air and in the soil in Japan, and we're starting to see particles like that appearing on the west coast of the U.S. in some of our other air samples.
If I understand correctly what you've said, for example, radiation from cigarettes, that would be something internal?
Correct. There's a certain amount of natural radiation in a cigarette. We take it into our lungs, and I think by now we all know that that's just one of the many reasons we get lung cancer from smoking.
What about, you know, we hear all the time, well, the radiation you're receiving is just like an airplane trip or a chest X-ray in that sense. Like, you know, what's the difference? Can you explain that to us?
Of course. These are short-term exposures that we're comparing the radiation to. A plane trip is a few hours. A dental X-ray takes a few moments. Your exposure is over. The trouble with particles is we can get these particles into our homes where they're going to constantly recycle and continue to expose people. That radiation exposure doesn't end after a few moments or a few hours. It can be continuous. And if we do absorb it in our bodies, and then we're going to get that dose potentially for the rest of our lives. So it's very important to distinguish radiation caused by these particles in dust and take extra measures to reduce that exposure.
People leaving the contaminated zone, for example, are still going to be getting these particles, these little pieces that we can't see when they breathe.
What's happening is these particles tend to stick to the nearest surface. They can stick to our clothing, to our skin, to concrete, even to things like carpeting or plant material. So if we want to reduce the exposure, we have to either prevent those particles from landing in the first place or clean them off or get rid of the affected clothing or even the affected soil that has to be removed. Anything to reduce that long-term exposure to the radioactive particles.
Your testing has found these little particles contaminated, you know, in just Japan or all over?
We see some of the same things appearing in our samples in the United States. What we've done at Worcester Polytech is set up a half dozen air sampling stations. They're on the western U.S. coast, the east coast, Hawaii, and Japan. And we look at some of the radioactive materials we see in Japan, like radioactive iodine, radioactive cesium, or these particles that contain americium and similar materials. And we see the same signature in our samples from the United States. There are less of them, but they're still there, and they're clearly related to the Fukushima release.
Find that complete interview with Marco Kaltofen at fairwinds.com. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I began my series of podcasts, the Japan Atomic Emergency Bulletins, on the day of the quake, March 11th. I knew right away this nuclear accident, actually a series of nuclear accidents in Japan, was huge, historic, dangerous. Early on, I predicted a big chunk of central Japan would eventually become unsafe for human habitation. In my opinion, the Japanese government has denied or delayed proper evacuation of its citizens for too long. People were allowed to stay in the highly toxic 20-kilometer zone for up to a month. Then anyone was allowed to drive in. Now it has been sealed off, but just this week residents were allowed to go back to haul out more radioactive belongings. The government just went out recently, finally, to test those piles of debris, the refrigerators, electronics, clothing, cars, trees, and poles and metal bits all washed around by this tsunami. It was radioactive for many kilometers around the plant. Everything is. 2 months after the accident, and this is one of those stories that make my blood boil, the government has released an aerial map of the true radiation zone. Even this may not be the full story, but let's call this map one step closer to the truth. The Japanese agencies appear to be prodded by and were certainly helped by the Americans. Here is NHK World TV from May 10th.
Japan's Nuclear Safety Commission says a new aerial map of radioactive fallout contamination has confirmed the radiation levels around the Fukushima Daiichi plant. It says the map will be effective in finding ways to lower radiation levels. The Japanese Science Ministry and the U.S. Energy Department conducted a joint aerial survey from April 6th to the 29th of the area within an 80-kilometer radius of the plant. The map shows the density of radioactive cesium in red or yellow, depending on the concentration in the soil. The high-density area lies northwest of the plant, coinciding with data collected on the ground. The commission's chairman, Haruki Madarame, told reporters on Monday that it's about time to review ways to carry out daily surveys on the ground.
I think it'll be possible to acquire more meticulous data by comparing the results of aerial mappings. It'll help to identify the areas that need to be more carefully monitored.
The broadcast version did not contain the line attributed to Madarame, "The situation at the power plant is stabilizing," at least in English, but the print version posted on the NHK website does. Now in just a few minutes, we'll see just how much, quote, "the situation at the power plant is stabilizing," end quote. In fact, just the opposite is happening. As reactors heat up, melt down, and spew radioactivity, while TEPCO flounders with make-it-up-as-you-go attempts to hold on. I invite you to go to the Radio EcoShock blog for this program titled Fukushima Unleashes Its Poisons. Find it at ecoshock.info. I've got links to all the stories in this show, including the video of this aerial survey map. What you can't hear in this story or in the mainstream news is simple. The map shows horrifying amounts of radiation extending far beyond the little 20-kilometer exclusion zone. A huge arm of radiation goes up to 80 kilometers out. The much-publicized daily radiation reports by the Nuclear Safety Commission of the Ministry of Education, based on the SPEEDY collection system, has never reported to this day the radiation levels in two prefectures, Fukushima and Miyagi, just north of the plant. Now we know why. They are largely poisoned. The education site did report regularly on Ibaraki Prefecture, directly south of Fukushima, and it was the highest on their chart, sitting above 1,000 grays per hour for several weeks. Now that prefecture is allegedly down to 210 grays per hour, still the highest shown in Japan, other than the two censored prefectures. I suggest that large parts of Miyagi and Ibaraki prefectures, and pretty well all of Fukushima prefecture, should have been evacuated when the explosions happened in the middle of March. Their rainwater, sewage, and soil, and everything about them is radioactive. At least save the children, whose developing organs will soak up the radioactivity, with less defense than adults. These children will live the 15 to 25 years it takes to develop cancers. The politicians and the utility operators may be dead by then. Or they may be as old men, sued, as the government of France is now being sued by the victims of thyroid cancer from Chernobyl. Check that out in the wiki entry that I quote in my blog. If there is a mass cancer in Japan within 25 years, I suspect the remaining decision-makers, the men who did not evacuate population living in radioactive zones, they could be hunted down like the Nazi war criminals were. Those are harsh words, I know, and these people, in their minds, they are trying to do the best they can. But what can we say about officials who encourage children to return to school, even in the 20 to 30 kilometer zone around Fukushima, who let them live where even the sewage is radioactive, where each night's wind brings the unseen radiation into their lungs and their lives? Here's NHK World News.
The mayor of Fukushima City has a great demand from parents and teachers to have radiation-contaminated topsoil removed from schoolyards. Outdoor radiation levels temporarily exceeded safety limits last month at 10 kindergartens, nurseries, and elementary and junior high schools in the city. The Municipal Board of Education says most elementary schools continue to have students play and study indoors. On Tuesday, members of the Federation of Local Parent Teacher Associations met with Mayor Takanori Seto. The PTAs requested that surface soil be removed from schoolyards to prevent children's exposure to radiation. They also demanded a briefing for concerned parents by municipal officials and radiation experts. Mayor Seto said the city will start removing soil from the schoolyards as soon as it decides on the most effective method.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with more news from the developing nuclear disaster at Fukushima, Japan. We just heard Japanese TV reporting this about an official pronouncement.
The situation at the power plant is stabilizing.
Here is what the Japanese-American nuclear physicist Michio Kaku said about this stabilizing nuclear plant on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
So when the utility says that things are stable, it's only stable in the sense that you're dangling from a cliff, hanging by your fingernails, and as the time goes by, each fingernail starts to crack. That's the situation now.
Now let's get an update on how things are going, how the utility TEPCO and the government are bringing these reactors under control. Let's tune in to reactor number one at Fukushima Daiichi, Japan. On the 27th of April, Bloomberg News reported radiation levels at reactor one rose to the highest levels measured since the March 11th quake. A pair of robots measured an astounding 1,120 millisieverts per hour of radiation. If I calculate correctly, that's about 112,000 millirems per hour in American measurements. Then it got worse. The temperature inside this first reactor kept rising, and there is only one reason why. Supposedly, the atomic reaction was stopped when the control rods were automatically dropped into the reactor at the time of the quake. But when the electricity powering the cooling pumps failed, at least half the fuel rods melted down, as TEPCO admits. There was a big hydrogen explosion which severely damaged the outer concrete building. In a rush to replace cooling water, TEPCO pumped in thousands of tons of salty seawater for a couple of weeks until urged to use fresh water barged in by the Americans. Tons of salt built up in the reactor itself, we think. Who knows what it's blocking? And stainless steel piping in the plant would start rapid corrosion. David Lochbaum of the Union of Concerned Scientists suggested water was not even reaching the fuel rods, a theory accepted weeks later by TEPCO. This past week, the utility sent the first humans to any of the reactors into Reactor 1. They set up long tubes and pumps trying to remove radioactive air from the inner building. The highly radioactive air in the building was blown out through the upper vents into the atmosphere. This was done at night, hopefully with the wind blowing the radiation out into the Pacific. Heaven help those creatures there. But nothing in air moves just one way. I'm sure some of it would have reached the land as well. According to Xinhua China News and other sources, just by opening the doors to reactor number 1, the workers blew another 500 million becquerels of radioactive materials into the atmosphere. It was an extravaganza of radioactive pollution that hardly anyone has heard about, and it didn't work. Since then, Japanese NHK World reports on May 10th.
Elevated radiation levels are again hampering the work to bring the troubled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant under control. Tokyo Electric Power Company says it may need to slow down work at the number one reactor, raising concerns that the overall plans to repair the plant will be reviewed. The company measured radiation levels at several spots in the reactor building on Monday as part of its preparation to fill the containment vessel with water and restore a circulating cooling system. The company is concerned that the reactor's pipes are leaking radioactive water, contaminating the area. The test yielded a maximum of 700 millisieverts per hour, which would only allow workers to stay in the vicinity for around 20 minutes. However, employees spent half an hour doing the tests and were exposed to as much as 10.56 millisieverts of radiation. TEPCO says the figures are higher than acceptable for worker safety.
We hope that radiation levels would go down to 1 millisievert per hour, but things didn't work out that way. We need to bring in some shielding system or clear out the highly contaminated rubble.
On Tuesday, the firm will attempt measures to reduce radiation levels, including laying down sheets containing lead to insulate the radioactive substances. It will continue checking the levels, but is worried that it may need to change plans depending on the results.
Since the company can't seem to get water directly into the reactor, TEPCO's plan remains flooding the containment building of Reactor 1 around it, a risky experiment never tried in nuclear operation history. It was never designed for. There is a danger the extra weight of all that water in a damaged building, or with a further earthquake, could wreck the inner reactor, exposing it to the air. Nobody knows. Last week, the company temporarily gave up this effort as the pressure inside Reactor 1 dropped towards zero, which could draw in outside oxygen, fueling another dangerous hydrogen explosion. Water pumping was lowered from 20 tons a day to just 6 tons a day. Workers have gone back in lately to install some gauges, even though lead shielding mats only reduced high radiation inside by a meager 10%. We'll talk about those workers soon. Are they expendable? This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, dragged back into the ongoing nuclear accident in Japan. Okay, let's go to Reactor 2. Reactor 2 is probably the most seriously damaged. It has a hole in it. Lava-like nuclear fuel is pooled in the bottom, possibly leaking out into the lower apparatus or building basement. Certainly, highly radioactive water, tons and tons more of it every day, is passing directly through the melted fuel into various catchments, the basements and trenches, and the subsoil. TEPCO is trying to catch some of it for storage or treatment later. Reactor 2 is also smoking, releasing radioactive steam each and every day. It is a nuclear accident out of control. And yet that seems almost better than the monster next door, Reactor 3. NHK World typically understates the situation this way.
The utility also says the temperature of the plant's number 3 reactor has been rising this month. and that its efforts to cool the reactor by pumping water into it may not be sufficient. TEPCO says it is installing new pipes to the reactor in hopes to start pumping water through them on Thursday.
It may be insufficient because the temperature inside Reactor 3 keeps rising and rising. At one point, it was measured above 300 degrees centigrade, at least 572 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the operating temperature of a live reactor. There are a lot of different reports out there about this. The media tends to chime in if temperatures drop, but not when they go high. One report from Mainichi News Japan puts Reactor 3 at 217 degrees C on May 8th. NHK World tells us the cooler temperature measured down at the bottom of the reactor at 150.6 degrees C on May 10th, right there in Japan. Let's listen to this report from NHK World on May the 10th.
The operator of the troubled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant is to begin construction work on pipes for the number 3 reactor to make sure that all cooling water being pumped in is actually reaching the reactor. Tokyo Electric Power Company has been pumping 9 tons of water per hour into the reactor since Wednesday after its temperature began rising earlier this month. The flow was boosted from 7 tons per hour, but the temperature at the bottom of the reactor stood at 150.6 degrees Celsius as of 5 a.m. Tuesday, marking a rise of 34.1 degrees over the past 10 days. The power company suspects that not all the water was reaching the reactor because some of it may have entered pipes that branched off. The utility then decided to pump the water through another pipe, which is directly connected to the reactor. The work to change pipes will begin on Tuesday afternoon. If successful, pumping through the directly connected pipe will commence on Thursday.
Again, the print version online for that broadcast, which is obviously not a transcript of what really is said on television, it adds, the water level inside a tunnel connected to the reactor was 76 centimeters from the tunnel opening on the ground surface as of 7 a.m. Tuesday, a 16-centimeter rise over the past 10 days. The level continues to exceed the 1-meter mark, which the utility has set as the benchmark to begin transferring contaminated water. The firm plans to quickly prepare to transfer contaminated water from the number 3 reactor turbine building and the tunnel. So it's starting to flood, and they don't mention that on the television. The top story of the 4-story Reactor 3 building is missing entirely, blown away by the hydrogen explosion in mid-March. And the third story is just a bunch of wreckage you can see right through. In high-resolution photos, the spent fuel pond, loaded with highly radioactive fuel rods, appears partly blown away somewhere. Until May 10th, TEPCO appeared to say nothing about the condition of this spent fuel pond at Reactor 3. Apparently, docile Japanese reporters did not ask about it, even though this is the most likely source of the fuel rods found outside in the grounds of the plant and even a mile beyond the plant boundaries. Finally, again on May 10th, when TEPCO seems to have divulged a flurry of overdue news, the company reported something about the Reactor 3 pool. They showed a video of water covering an area where the fuel rods used to be amid extreme damage amounting to piles of rubble over and in the fuel pond. Only a small part of the fuel pond is shown, presumably the part that is still there, but it is containing water, it seems. So we just don't know the true state of this facility. I wish we could get accurate reports from TEPCO and from the government. Let's listen to this carefully manicured projection by NHK World.
Tokyo Electric Power Company has detected high levels of radioactive materials in the spent fuel pool of the number 3 reactor at the Fukushima Daiichi. TEPCO examined the water sample from the pool on Sunday. It contained 140,000 becquerels of radioactive cesium-134 per cubic centimeter, 150,000 becquerels of cesium-137, and 11,000 becquerels of iodine-131. The radioactive iodine is leading TEPCO to believe these substances may have come from damaged fuel rods in the reactor rather than the damaged spent fuel rods in the pool. Iodine-131 is generated during nuclear fission inside a reactor. The substance has a short half-life. The utility says the radioactive substances may have become attached to debris and entered the spent fuel pool together. None of these substances was detected during an inspection on March 2nd before the accident triggered by the March 11th disaster.
Again, TEPCO denies anything bad happened to the fuel rods themselves. despite the horrendous explosion and missing parts of the building. The extra radiation is supposed to come from radioactive debris falling in, or, ominously, from damaged fuel rods in the reactor. How does radiation from the reactor get into the spent fuel pool? Is the reactor containment so damaged? Stop asking such obvious questions. These are the ones never answered in the mysterious press releases from TEPCO, the government, or any of the Japanese agencies. Maybe they don't know. Certainly, they don't say. We've already talked about the risk of the Reactor 4 falling over. You can watch the polluted steam or smoke always coming from that building. Authorities admit continuous flooding of the basements, trenches, and we presume the groundwater from that reactor. Seldom mentioned, reactors 5 and 6 are also flooding with water, also becoming unstable in the soaked radioactive ground and foundations. This is a collection of disasters. They don't happen fast enough to catch our attention, except for the occasional spectacular leak, fire, or explosion. Now we don't bother reporting even that. 500 million becquerels of radiation escapes when we open the doors. Ha! That was nothing, some authority says. Nothing. Just 1/300th of all the radioactive poison we dumped into the sea one day last month. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm angry my world has been polluted just to light up neon signs somewhere. I'm angry my own government is doing the very same thing, running the same risk of closing off big parts of the countryside and even major cities to fill any wasteful demand for electricity at all. I'm sad for all the displaced people in Japan from the tsunami that has almost disappeared from the news. They are almost helpless. Now all that is left is entire towns full of rubble and some bodies still not found. I understand that the leaders of Japan and Tokyo Electric Power are just humans. They could give up, but they will not. As I said at the start of this program, I applaud the announcements by Prime Minister Kan to close down the dangerous Hamaoka nuclear plant, to stop the construction of 14 planned new reactors, and to search for the truly safe, clean, sustainable energy that Japan needs. But this bold search for the new Japan calls on the people to admit one more shame, the dirty secret of how that country's nuclear industry has used the most defenseless people to clean up their mess. Those workers are expected to go away and die as unreported casualties of radiation sickness and deadly cancer. Japan has a history of using outcasts for the most menial work. Over long feudal time, they created a lower caste for such jobs. This continued into modern times, and some untrained, almost uneducated, casual workers have been employed to clean up nuclear accidents, reportedly with just buckets and towels, with no protective equipment. You can find evidence in the film Nuclear Ginza, produced in 1995 for the UK television channel 4. The film starts in Japanese with English subtitles, then weaves in English language narration. You hear the stories of the people, see the images of low-class or homeless workers used by the nuclear industry time and again for very little pay. In some cases, nobody explained the risk, nobody kept track of their dose, and they ignored obvious signs of radiation poisoning. If a lawsuit arose, the victim was paid off, the film says.
I am Kenji Higuchi. I stumbled upon these stories as a young photographer 20 years ago. It changed my life. The scenes I saw, the stories I heard, I found them difficult to believe at first. That workers go near their reactor and get exposed, and that many of them become ill with radiation sickness and sometimes die. Or that these people are farmers and fishermen or even laborers picked off the streets in the slums of Osaka and Tokyo. But when I started looking, I found so many of these people, people who didn't know what had happened to them, or if they did, too frightened to speak out. The thing that struck me was that all their stories were the same. During these years, I have scratched below the surface and have discovered the underside of Japan, a side the world knows nothing about. People simply don't believe this can happen in a country like Japan, a country where the companies are famous for treating workers so well. 3 hours train ride from here lies the nuclear Ginza. 15 reactors lined up one after the other along the Japan Sea coast. Among them, the world's first fast breeder reactor built last year.
Blogger Sarah Norbach writes on April 1, 2011, quote, back in 1995, the UK's Channel 4 produced a 30-minute documentary on Japan's nuclear industry and how they use disadvantaged people, including Bakurim and other day laborers, to do manual labor inside their power plants. And by inside, I mean inside. Some were forced to work right next to the room where the core was kept, in the dark and drenched in sweat. One man tells how he was forced to mop up radioactive water with towels. End quote. See that complete half-hour documentary at japansubculture.com or find the link in my blog at ecoshock.info.
The spiral of discrimination is never-ending. Murai is ostracized from his community because of his illness. Exactly the same has happened to survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. It is terrible that the only country on which the nuclear bomb was dropped has produced the same suffering from its own nuclear power stations. This is the kind of country we live in. I cannot accept it.
In the very popular financial blog called The Automatic Earth, one writer is called Stoneleigh, and in her career as Nicole Foss. Nicole was a relatively recent guest on Radio EcoShock. She has a degree and experience in evaluating nuclear accidents. In Stoneleigh's recent moving and poignant post at The Automatic Earth, she explores the reported horrible conditions for workers at the Fukushima plant during this accident in the context of long-term abuse of nuclear workers in dangerous situations in Japan. You must read her May 10th post, Welcome to the Atomic Village, at theautomaticearth.blogspot.com, theautomaticearth.blogspot.com. Find that link in my blog, too. Stoneleigh explains the history of lower castes in Japan, from the Burakumin to the Yoshiba. There are many links in this article, including to another blog titled Dying for TEPCO, Fukushima's Nuclear Contract Workers, by Paul Jobin at japanfocus.org. Great article. How these use-them-and-lose-them workers are attracted by false advertisements or hustled up by Yakuza, according to the program Nuclear Ginza, by the gangsters. They face these workers incredible risks and are afterwards shunned, as today's Fukushima nuclear workers will be in Japan. Have you wondered how more than 1,000 TEPCO workers, some of them walked through radioactive water, wandered near record-high radiation outside the plants, slept there, ran through tunnels of irradiated water, while the utility claims there is not a single serious radiation injury, that nobody has suffered radiation poisoning or even gone over the recently raised acceptable levels? Here is Stoneleigh's conclusion, and I quote, it may be very difficult to undertake any future epidemiological study of the health effects of Fukushima liquidators as it was at Chernobyl, where little data was ever collected. You get the picture. We may never know what happened to these workers. Years later, as they sicken and die, we will hear the truth, perhaps, about the workers now at Fukushima, or maybe they will die in back alleys with no records to show. I say all this in full consciousness that here in North America we have our own outcasts who we use and abuse. In Canada, the First Nations Aboriginal people are beaten, poisoned on their own reserves, used as women, jailed and killed. In America, the jails are full of African Americans run through the so-called justice system by the millions. Just like Japan, our so-called nuclear regulators are often bribed or paid by the nuclear industry, and they use the revolving door to get big-paying jobs when they leave, as 68 Japanese nuclear regulators did. The same thing happens with the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's all a big boys' club, which is paid for by the industry, incidentally, and never turns down a license application. We have the same failed system. Japan has showed us the extreme consequences when nuclear things go wrong. Nobody here is without sin, but in the atomic world, there is no margin for errors like these. The atom is unforgiving, spreading the cancer to everyone in the world from any accident or terrorist act anywhere. We are not any of us perfect enough to use this technology. We see that now. In this time of extreme challenge, we need to help the Japanese people, and even that government which we criticize. acknowledging our own abuse of atomic knowledge, our own history of violence and secrecy, we plead with Japan to take that step above. Save your own children by evacuating them from anywhere near that big radiation zone. Spare the future of the nation. Protect the heroes who risk their lives trying to stop the next worst stage of this nuclear disaster. Treat them like heroes. And yes, go for clean energy. We all need to do it. You can lead us. And try even harder to tell your people and the people of the world the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I'm Alex Smith, and this has been Radio EcoShock. My thanks to all the listeners who sent in tips and links, and to the bloggers at the edge trying to keep the players honest. And thanks to California musician Vast Man. Find him on SoundClick.com for his occasional music, including Raining Radiation. Please tune in next week. If nothing blows up in Japan, we'll look at the problems right in our own streets, the developing energy prices that will change everything you take for granted. Starvation by oil next week, I hope, on Radio EcoShock. Our website is ecoshock.org. Find the blog for this program at ecoshock.info. Thanks for listening. After all that heavy stuff, I want to go out with the inspiration to change with the power of the feeling for our own land. So here's a song by Rachel Van Zanten. It's called My Country.
Take a good look at my country. It's a natural bona fide high. When you look up from the numbers on your paper, you might see Yaki Star pass you by. You might see it all pass you by. Cannot let this pass me by.